Pull up a chair. I want you to stand in a field in Lincolnshire, England, on the evening of May 16, 1943. The light is going gold and long the way it does in an English spring, and out on the grass sit 19 of the biggest airplanes Britain could build, Avro Lancasters. 4 Merlin engines apiece, black bellies and a smell coming off them of hot oil and high-octane fuel and rubber and rain-soaked canvas. The crews are young, most of them are barely old enough to buy a pint, and not one of them climbing up through that belly hatch tonight has been told what they've been training for. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar. And tonight I want to tell you about one of the most audacious things anybody ever tried to do with an airplane. The night they went to break the dams. Now before I get into it, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on tonight. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com Aviation Challenge Coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and that's the thing, isn't it? The little brass reminder in your pocket that says, I did that. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back to the dams. Germany's industrial heartland in 1943 was a valley called the Ruhr, steel, coal factories, the whole engine of the German war machine. And all of that industry ran on water. Water for the factories, water for the canals that moved the coal, water for the hydroelectric power. And that water was held back by a handful of enormous dams, the Moni, the Eder, the Sorp. We are talking about walls of concrete and masonry. The Moni Dam was better than 130 feet thick at its base. Massive. The kind of structure you look at and you think, nothing short of a direct hit with something enormous is ever going to scratch that. And here's the problem. You couldn't hit it. A conventional bomb dropped from altitude in 1943. You'd be lucky to put it within a few hundred yards of a target that size. And even if you did land one right on the crown of the dam, it would just crater the top. That wall was built to take pressure from the water side. You couldn't knock it down from the air. Not with anything anybody had. Torpedoes. The Germans had thought of that. They'd strung heavy anti-torpedo nets across the reservoirs, hanging down into the water. Run a torpedo at the dam and it snags in the netting a long way short and does nothing. So the dam sat there, untouchable. Everybody knew where they were, everybody knew how much they mattered, and nobody had the faintest idea how to break one, nobody except a quiet, stubborn engineer named Barnes Wallace. Now here's where it gets interesting. Wallace was an aircraft designer, brilliant man. He designed airships and bombers, and he got fixated on this dam problem. And he started thinking about it the way a kid thinks about skipping a stone across a pond. You've done it, everybody's done it. You get a flat stone, you throw it low and flat and with a lot of spin, and it skips, it bounces across the surface. And the spin is the secret. That backspin lets it kiss the water and hop, again and again, instead of just plunging in. Wallace thought, what if a bomb could do that? What if I could make a bomb skip across the surface of that reservoir, skip right over the torpedo nets, because the nets hang down and the bomb rides on top, skip until it reaches the face of the dam. And then when it hits that concrete wall, the backspin makes it crawl straight down the face, hugging the concrete, sinking down deep, until the water pressure itself holds it tight against the wall. And then it goes off, deep underwater, right against the base. Because water doesn't compress all that explosive force, instead of blowing outward into open air, gets driven straight into the dam. It's the difference between slapping the surface of a pond and setting off a firecracker in a sealed bottle. One does nothing, the other cracks the bottle. That was the idea. A bomb that skips like a stone, sinks like an anchor, and detonates like a depth charge against the one part of the dam that can't take it. On paper, it's beautiful. In practice, it very nearly drove everybody involved out of their minds. Because here's what it takes to make that skip work. And I want you pilots listening to really sit with these numbers, because they are brutal. To get the bounce right, that bomb had to be released from exactly 60 feet above the water, 60 feet, at night, over a black reservoir, with no radar altimeter you could trust down that low. I've flown low, you've flown low, 60 feet over water in the dark is nothing, that's below the treetops, that is a place where a moment's inattention, and you're simply gone, and there's no time to recover. And they had to hold it. Dead steady, 60 feet. The speed had to be exact too. Right around 230 miles an hour, faster or slower, and the skip breaks down, and the bomb either dives or shatters. And the release point had to be precise to within a few hundred yards of the dam, at night, with the Germans shooting at you the whole way in. So how do you fly a four-engine heavy bomber at exactly 60 feet over water in the dark? The instruments of the day couldn't tell you your height that accurately down low. So they got clever, low-tech and brilliant. They mounted two spotlights on the airplane, one up front, one back, angled so the two beams would meet, form a single figure eight of light on the water surface at exactly 60 feet. The flight engineer would lean out and watch those two circles of light on the black water, and he'd call it, down, down, and when the two spots merged into one, that was 60 feet. That was your height, right on the money.
And the range to the dam. How do you know when you've reached the exact release point? They built a little handheld wooden sight. A triangle of plywood with two nails sticking up. The Moni Dam had two towers on it, a known distance apart. The bomb aimer would hold up this little wooden gadget, line the two nails up with the two towers, and when they matched, he'd let the weapon go. A piece of plywood and two nails, solving a targeting problem that the best minds in Europe couldn't crack. Now the weapon itself. Everybody calls it the bouncing bomb, and I love that, but it didn't look like a bomb. It looked like a drum, a cylinder, and before release, a motor in the belly of the Lancaster spun that drum up backward to better than 500 revolutions a minute. You could feel it. The whole airframe would buzz and shudder with the spin of the thing. Get it turning, get down to 60 feet, hit 230 miles an hour, line up the nails with the towers, and let it go. The squadron they built for this was brand new. 617 Squadron formed in secret for this one job, and to lead it, they picked a 24-year-old wing commander named Guy Gibson, 24 years old and already an old hand, hundreds of operations behind him. They gave Gibson the pick of the crews, told him practically nothing at first, and set him to training these men in low-level flying, night after night after night. So low, the locals were writing letters of complaint about maniacs buzzing the church steeples. They practiced over English lakes and reservoirs, 60 feet, Merlin snarling. Learning to fly a heavy bomber like it was a fighter, down in the weeds, in the dark, and on the night of May 16th, they finally found out why. 19 Lancasters took off in waves into that Lincolnshire dusk. They flew across the North Sea at wavetop height, so low the gunners could see the spray, deliberately down there to slip under the German radar across the enemy coast, down into the valleys, following rivers and canals like roads, map reading by moonlight at 100 feet.
And it cost them. It cost them going in. Airplanes hit power lines. Airplanes caught flak. Some went down before they ever reached a dam. Whole crews gone in a heartbeat of orange light against the dark. This was not a clean operation. Nothing about it was clean. But they reached the Moni. Picture it. The reservoir black and calm and enormous. The dam a pale wall across the end of it. And on the towers, German gunners, wide awake now, throwing up a wall of tracer. Streams of glowing fire reaching out across the water. And into that one Lancaster drops down to 60 feet. Spotlights on. Two circles of light chasing across the black water toward each other, bombs spinning up in the belly. 230 miles an hour, straight and level, straight into the guns. No jinking, no evading. Because if you move, you break the run, and it's all for nothing.
Now, I'm not going to sit here and dress this up as a fairy tale, because it wasn't. Of the 133 men who flew that night, 53 did not come home.
more than half a squadron gone in a single operation, and down in the valleys below the Eder and the Moni, the flood killed well over 1,000 people on the ground, many of them prisoners and forced laborers who had nothing to do with any of it. The raid did real damage to German industry, and the Germans had those dams substantially rebuilt within months. Historians have argued the cost against the effect ever since, and they should, but that's not really why we remember it. Pull up a chair and I'll tell you why I think it still matters. It matters because a stubborn engineer looked at an impossible problem and thought about skipping stones on a pond. It matters because when the technology of the day couldn't measure 60 feet, somebody crossed two spotlights on the water instead. It matters because a targeting computer, in 1943, was a triangle of plywood and two nails held up by a 19-year-old with steady hands. That is aviation at its purest. That is human beings refusing to accept that a thing can't be done, and then flying straight into the guns to prove it. The Avro Lancaster, by the way, is one of the loveliest heavy airplanes ever built, and there are only a couple left flying in all the world. If you ever get the chance to stand under one and hear four Merlins light off, you go. You go and you stand there, and you feel it in your chest, and you think about those boys down at 60 feet in the dark. My thanks tonight to the Royal Air Force Museum and the historians at the Imperial War Museum, whose records keep the details of Operation Chastise straight, and to the memory of Barnes Wallace, who never stopped tinkering. You can find us at radiohangar.com if you want to sit in the hangar a while longer. 60 feet in the dark, and they held it steady. Next time you think you can't fly a maneuver, remember what steady hands and a good idea can do? This is Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.